All right, here we go. Another episode of Hyphenated Life.
Yes.
We're recording in the afternoon, beautiful fall afternoon here in Boulder, Colorado, and we're going to have David Plazas on today. David is a journalist for the Tennessean back in Nashville, which are your stomping grounds, right, Andrew?
For sure, yeah. I went to Belmont University, and we're recording this actually right before the last presidential debate hosted by Belmont University. Thank you very much.
Is it really? No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
What's their mascot? It's not the Bruins.
The Bruins.
Oh.
It used to be the Rebels. Uh-huh. It used to be the Belmont Rebels, yeah. But they were Baptists once upon a time, so they changed their mascot to a cuddly bear, I guess.
Is that what a Bruin is?
Yes.
Okay.
It's apparently a bear.
So you went from being a cuddly bear to a demon deacon. That's a fun transition.
It is a fun transition. Definitely. Yeah. So I know David Plazas through one of my BFFs who lives in Nashville. He's a music minister. He's also a producer and songwriter. And so I met David Plazas through my friend Steven, and so grateful for that connection and really grateful for David Plazas being willing to come on to this brand new podcast. We're really lucky to have him today.
Yeah, I was excited looking through his sort of his oeuvre of work with the Tennessean. He started a
oeuvre. Nice. You're so French.
Merci beaucoup. he's during the pandemic, he started a sort of video podcast where he interviews folks from Tennessee, from politicians to community advocates and people doing good work. And it was really inspiring to see it. And he is plowing through those at an inspirational rate. He's over 100 triple digits in the last.
Yeah, as of right now, I think they just finished episode 102.
That's awesome.
We can only be so fortunate as to record 102 episodes of Hyphenated Life, of course.
We'll get there. Point. Yeah, not in the first season, but we'll get there eventually. So we do about 12 episodes a season. That's going to be a few seasons away before we get to triple digits. And
David just recorded an interview on the Tennessee Voices podcast, which was, I believe, what he started during pandemic as his own creative project. And just recently recorded a conversation with Carol Hudler, who is a retired publisher and a nonprofit leader, and talks a little bit about that around what newspaper organizations are like today, kind of moving to digital-centered, you know, publication and not those traditional channels. So I'm really curious also to kind of hear from David today about what the newspaper business is like these days and how he's adapted to that new format and that new reality that the churches have adapted to as well, obviously, being online all the time.
Right, you have churches, newspapers, and classical music. That's a realm, journalism, media, news. It's a realm that's a hot topic today, and it really does cross those lines of sacred and secular worlds organizationally, functionally.
Right.
And so I think you'll have a lot to contribute to Hyphenated Life.
I agree. I'm really curious too. I mean, we live in a time of quote unquote fake news. To some degree, some attack on freedom of the press, right? So,
enemy of the people.
Right. And misinformation campaigns and how you manage that in a digital space that morphs and mushrooms out in all these different ways. I think that's a big deal right now. And we look forward to hearing from David today talking about freedom of the press and what that means for someone who lives that reality every day.
The Bible is a story of, it's a compilation of liberation stories, right? The Bible is about soul freedom and spiritual freedom, and freedom of the press is critical. You know, like these ideas of freedom also can't be separated into sacred and secular. It's a ethos, and it was an ethos that our country was founded on. And when you start making false accusations against the media,
a big misunderstanding right now is the difference between religious organizations that are political and ones that are partisan. And I think that, you know, when you start breaking that down, I think when you start addressing the big issues of the day, people believe you're being partisan somehow. Mm-hmm. Jesus suffered a political execution. Like, mm-hmm. he threatened the political powers of his time.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, especially in the Trump era, you know, I think those turn signals are really mixed up.
David Palacios talks about his work convening conversations with diverse groups, mm-hmm. advocating for space for public disagreement and modeling and promoting civil conversations in a polarized time. That's mm-hmm. like, he wants people to disagree productively and not combatively.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that going back to the idea of cooperation in conflict versus combat in conflict. So having a healthy debate, there's nothing wrong with an argument, but, you know, respect, like coming from a foundation of equality, it almost comes back to social justice. Like, we are on the same level. We are both humans. You know, we are all humans. Yeah. We are humanity, and let's be civil about this.
You're on it.
I don't know. We'll see where it goes. I'm going to give you a heads up. I'll probably make a joke about newspapers.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's your joke?
I don't know yet. When it comes to me, I'll know. And you'll know.
Welcome to Hyphenated Life. We invite you to join us on this journey to explore the connection of the sacred and the secular that inspires us to become more fully alive. Today, we are so delighted to welcome David Plazas onto Hyphenated Life. David is Opinion and Engagement Director for the USA Today Network, Tennessee. David writes editorials and columns and oversees the opinion team and strategy for multiple large and small publications across the state, including the Tennessean. His award-winning work has focused on inequities in the public school system, affordable housing, transit, and local and state politics. As the leader of the Civility Tennessee campaign, which began in 2018, he seeks to promote, encourage, and model civically engaged practices that focus on citizen empowerment and democratic renewal. He has frequently moderated debates, forums, and community conversations. During COVID-19, he started the Tennessee Voices video podcast, which is a show featuring conversations with leaders, thinkers, and innovators from across the state. He holds master's degrees in journalism and business administration. He resides with his husband, Darren, and their two chihuahuas in Nashville. David Plazas, welcome to Hyphenated Life.
Andrew, thank you so much. Hello, David. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you, David.
And so, David, we're just going to see where this conversation goes today in some ways, but I know that you are very passionate in terms of how you are convening conversations with diverse groups there in Nashville. You're advocating for space for public disagreement, which is very intriguing, and modeling and promoting civil conversations in what we know is a polarized time politically and religiously. We're just a few days away, apparently, from a presidential election. I'm not sure that our listeners have heard about that, but that is coming up. So, David, let's just start by hearing from you about what really engages your passions professionally in terms of how you're convening those conversations with diverse groups and looking to create space for public disagreement during this really crazy time.
Thanks so much, Andrew. And we're recording this just a few days before the final presidential debate, which is happening in Nashville, Tennessee at Belmont University.
That's right, my alma mater.
So it will be, it's supposed to be a circus, but I'm hoping that we'll have some good questions that are asked and answered. Incidentally, I'm hosting a debate watch party that night on the Civility Tennessee page we're going to be discussing topics such as not who won the debate, because it's so subjective, but did they answer the questions that they were asked? And I think this is at the heart of getting to civic engagement. It's not about picking winners or losers, because sometimes it's not about, you know, winning the argument per se, but it's about an exchange of ideas and an opportunity to create a relationship where you build respect. I like to say, and it's not necessarily original, although I've modified it to make me comfortable with it, which is, you know, facts don't change people's minds, but relationships can. And imagine if you have a good working relationship with somebody who may not see something in the same way, whether it's something like same-sex marriage or climate change or healthcare access. You know, if you talk about the power of storytelling is so compelling. And as a journalist, as a storyteller, you know, I think that I can use those skills to help people. I grew up in a somewhat idyllic situation where my parents really encouraged debate at the dining room table. And they encouraged, though, civil debate where you respected one another and you could disagree, but you weren't going to get ugly about it. And that helped model from a very early age how I thought about it. And I've been a reader since I was a little kid. I read 2 newspapers growing up. I was a big nerd, you know, loved to read. And I think that was really important in terms of my upbringing to understand that, in fact, I could consider different points of view. And I had the privilege of being in classes that challenged me to understand and argue points of view that weren't mine. I was in the constitutional law class where I was arguing on behalf of a totalitarian Chinese government on why censorship was good, which is precisely not my point of view. I don't agree with that. But it was interesting to see how you can argue these fine points. There are times when it's very difficult to have a civil discussion when people try to minimize your worth or your dignity. At that point, it's really difficult. It's really challenging. And it may be impossible. But I think most people do care about having good relationships. Sometimes they just don't know. And sometimes, I'll tell you a quick factor before I stop, but research from Pew Center and also from the American Press Institute show that only 20% of Americans have ever met a journalist. So 80% of the people have an impression of a journalist based upon what they may have heard or seen. And so sometimes that's why our reputation is so bad, because we're suddenly not the person who shops with you, goes to worship with you, has a conversation with you over coffee. We're that enemy, you know, enemy of the people. And that's one of my compelling reasons why I do this, is because the press is essential to working democracy. And it's in my interest, and I think in the interest of my fellow citizens, to have a healthy democracy.
Thank you, David. Certainly we're living in a time where there is an attack happening on freedom of the press. And so you have just recently interviewed, I believe, someone who is a mentor of yours, Carol Hudler, and you talk about how the news publication industry has gone through such a tumultuous 20 years with online platforms and sort of the new tradition, so to speak, of what's going on with the newspaper business. What have you observed in your own day-to-day experience? I think it's very interesting how so few people know journalists in their lives. What are some of the stereotypes that you, if you could just say, that you would love to blast, especially in terms of what's going on today with the rhetoric of fake news and with the freedom of the press?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I think some of the things that we often hear is that journalists don't care about the community, that we just, you know, it'll only lead if it bleeds, or whatever the expression is, and that it's about sensationalism. And the reality is that that's not healthy journalism. You know, I think many publications have unfortunately had incidents where either we've made mistakes or by someone's decision to be less community oriented. And when I started doing the work that I was doing in 2006, actually, with community conversations, it was really considered radical back then. And today it's essential, I think, for us to survive. Different newspaper platforms have had different successes. You know, New York Times and Washington Post are doing really, really well in this time. A lot of local newspapers are not. You know, a lot of local newspapers have shrunk significantly. And there's also this perception, because the newspaper has shrunk, the physical print newspaper has shrunk so much, that newspaper companies aren't doing so well. It's kind of a mixed bag, because our consumers are going to the digital realm. We have to be where they are. And to give, you know, just give you an idea of why it's been so disruptive. If you remember Craigslist, when it first came out, you know, it offered classified ads for free. Classified ads were what funded newsrooms. You know, this was an essential part of the newspaper business. And then that went away. And then you had Google and Facebook and other players come in and essentially dominate the digital advertising space. So suddenly we were making pennies. And so one of the seemingly minor myths that I try to debunk is when someone says, I read it on Facebook. I'm like, no, you probably read it from me or read it from one of my colleagues. You know, and our challenge is basically saying that this is in fact something that has been vetted. This is something that we've put time into it and that we need your help to invest and to stay healthy. Because unfortunately, you know, our business model is one where even though the First Amendment gives us the right to a free press, it doesn't guarantee our success as a free press. And so we have to be very mindful of that. And I'm no longer afraid to ask people to subscribe to their local newspaper because it's at the lifeblood of who is covering those local issues. I'm very much focused on local and state issues in my daily life because I think sometimes as much as we think about the polarized and national environment and the presidential race, those local issues are far more important. Your sidewalk issues, transit, you know, even something as seemingly minor as garbage pickup or landfills. I mean, those have massive consequences when it comes to the environment and our quality of life. And these are things that are covered by local journalists. And we have to do it in different ways than we did before. We just don't have the staffs that we used to have, at least most of us don't. There's also the question of, you know, the business model right now, in a sense, and it's somewhat of a perverse statement, but Trump has been good for some media organizations, because if you continue to enrage and you continue to pin yourself as the anti-President Trump, there is money to be made there. And there are certainly people who, you know, the question will be, depending on the November 3rd election results, what will happen? You know, at this moment, there was always the joke of what happens to Saturday Night Live if the president is not as interesting as the previous one, you know, and so, right. You know, but I think that the responsible media organization is one that looks long-term to say, what is our ultimate goal? If our goal is to benefit our community, we have to be consistent and transparent and honest and also adapt as we need to, because our business has changed. You know, there's a wonderful picture that shows in the early 20th century, all these horses and buggies that are in New York City and a few, you know, early automobiles during that time. And then, you know, come just a few decades later and it's almost all automobiles and a few horses and buggies. Transportation is still essential, but it's just different. And information is still essential, but it's just different. And I don't know how we're going to look like in 5 years necessarily. I think there'll still be a demand for it. The question is, will people have developed the attention span to understand what they're reading? And probably the biggest crisis, I think, aside from misinformation and disinformation, is consumers who don't have news literacy. And that's one of the things that I focus on with the Civility campaign. It's not to tell you how to think, but it's to provide some guidance on how to approach an article. You know, how do you know it's true? You know, how can you tell where the sources came from? You know, is it something, someone who's credible? Or, you know, or how can you verify this to ensure that it's there? And if you have a complaint about it, how can I do that? How can I counter this? How can I get a correction? How can I make sure that my voice is heard? Because sometimes, you know, there are some things people see things differently. And I think that's okay. The question is, when we start dismissing facts outright, that's really dangerous for a democracy.
David, I can't thank you enough. I wish I could have bullet pointed. There are probably about 20 things in there that I think everyone in our country should read every day that they wake up, at least maybe should have for the past several years. There are a lot of elements of news coverage and journalism and discourse that have gotten really toxic and divisive and politicized. I was going through some of your Tennessee Voices video podcast interviews, and I loved how so many of them weren't on things like if it bleeds, it leads. It was on things on spotlighting who is healing that bleeding. And so bringing up the positive side of solving problems in our society and whatnot. And I think for me, that's largely where I think this idea of news coverage and media and journalism can really double dip into this sacred and secular worlds. You know, we want to celebrate social justice, and highlighting that isn't necessarily always the most popular thing to do as far as the clickbait concept, Andrew and I were talking about, in the medical world, doctors take a Hippocratic oath, and it's sort of a moral and ethical oath that they take. And I was wondering, I could probably Google it, but is there something similar in the world of journalism? And if so, where does that come from? What does it mean to you? And if there isn't one, you know, what you've been describing, what all these things mean to you. But I think the sort of moral and ethical impetus behind good journalism is important.
Absolutely. You know, one thing, there is and there isn't. And what I mean by that is that there's no national panel that dictates how journalists are supposed to comport themselves. Because one of the things that the First Amendment allows is anybody to have a press. So I don't need a license to be a practicing journalist. I just need to be hired by someone to distribute news. So within this sphere, we've had these conversations about bloggers, about pundits, about, and so that's why it all gets muddled, because sometimes when people talk about the media, they try to include all of this. And one of the things I try to debunk is, you know, we're all very different organizations. You know, we have different codes of ethics. And for us, ethics is really important. In my organization, our code of ethics is modeled after the Society of Professional Journalists code of ethics. It's a voluntary organization, but many journalists like myself are members because we believe that how we act and how we comport ourselves is really important, not just for our long-term viability, but because it's the right thing to do. And just to highlight some of the aspects of that code of ethics, you know, a lot of it is just very common sense, but you have to do it. One of them is seek truth and report it. You know, another one is minimize harm. Another one is act independently, be accountable and transparent. So those four basic principles, which have multiple bullet points, and I'll be happy to share with you the link to the SPJ, but if you look at Society of Professional Journalists Ethical Code of Ethics, you'll find it there. And it's very specific, because you don't misrepresent yourself. You know, you seek to do your best to tell the truth. You know, sometimes this is why you see a lot of articles, so-and-so said, because sometimes it's what that person's perspective is if you haven't seen something yourself. But developing that credibility is really important too. I'm glad you mentioned public transit, because one of the year-long projects that I did a few years ago, which has been one of the most meaningful to me, was on affordable housing. It was called The Cost of Growth and Change in Nashville. And the way that I got the idea was I was riding the bus for a whole year, once a week at least. And I was just listening to people's conversations. And people kept on talking about the rising cost of living. Now, it's not unique to Nashville, big cities, whether it's Denver or New York or Los Angeles. I mean, housing has gotten very expensive over the last decade or so. And as I kept on hearing these, I started looking at the data and seeing, is this true? And in fact, what I found was that whereas rents had gone up exponentially, you know, almost 60%, you know, salaries went up less than 10%. There was a major disconnect between what people made and what they could afford. And in part, it was because we had a lot of transplants coming in, making more money, who could afford those kinds of rents, pushing people outside of the city. But if I hadn't been listening, and if I hadn't, you know, pre-pandemic, I took Lyft and Uber quite a bit. I like to talk to my driver, you know, what's going on, you know, just to listen. And it's one perspective, but that theme kept on coming up about what is happening to us. Who are we? What's our identity? And that was a way to really explore that even further. I had a ride a few years ago when I first started the civility campaign, and I came from, you know, I was all jazzed up from listening to this gentleman who gave this wonderful speech on civic engagement and, you know, feel good about yourself, everybody be kind to each other. I get my Lyft ride, and the driver starts talking to me about this transportation referendum that was ongoing at the time. And, you know, and I corrected her. I said, well, actually, it's this. And she looks at me and says, people like you are ruining this city. And I was thinking, so what do you mean? And she apologized, but she stopped herself. She said what she was from Nashville, native Nashvillian, and she never benefited from the growth that you saw in downtown Nashville. She felt on the periphery. And the irony, of course, was she's driving someone around who is a transplant in her car and who's helping her make ends meet. And that's one of the challenges that to me it was a big aha moment, because it was like, what are we doing that we are creating situations of where people can't afford to live in their own city, where they don't recognize it? And by the way, that referendum was defeated handily, because there were a lot more people like her who felt disconnected from the argument. Had those pushing the referendum listened and bothered to think, is this something that people really want or need, that they're willing to pay for, that they're willing to wait for? And, you know, when they lost badly, but, you know, 2/3 of the vote went against it. So that was a big lesson, I think, for the city and for me, too.
So, David, I'm going to circle back to your Tennessee Voices video podcast. I think that kind of creative project that you, with 102 episodes so far, right? I mean, that's phenomenal. This is probably an impossible question, but are there some standout moments or interviews or topics that have bubbled up through this creative project with Tennessee Voices that you would hold up as a model or a talking point that really relates to living in this kind of polarized society right now? Are there any conversations or interviews that come to mind?
Yes. And I was asked a similar question a few days ago after I had published Carol Hudler's podcast. And one that continues to be with me in a very powerful way and meaningful way was with a woman named Allie Drescher. She is a grief counselor at Alive Hospice. And I had recorded the podcast with her in early April. So the pandemic was with us just for a few weeks. You know, it had emerged in Nashville officially in early March. We didn't know much about it. People were very scared. And it was a very beautiful conversation because she told me how she talks to people, how families, about death and dying. And in a way that wasn't scary, in a way that was about, you know, this is a difficult time, but let's prepare ourselves. And I always ask guests, you know, what are the things that they like to do to help them cope? And she talked about making mandalas, which are circles that come from the Hindu tradition, and how that helps her center herself. And I'll always remember that because it took me to a much better place, even though we were talking about this subject that was so challenging and something that I was not necessarily looking forward to speaking about. She made it so accessible because now we weren't talking about morbid things. We were talking about love. We were talking about kindness. We were talking about trying to do our best in a challenging time, even though it hurts badly. And I still to this day, that's the one that gives me goosebumps still. And there are many other conversations too that I've really enjoyed, but that one in particular, because it was the depth and also her serenity. I think oftentimes, especially when we get in crisis mode or are nervous, you know, we're not able to keep our composure. But she every day has to have these conversations and has learned, you know, how to say things that people are finding difficult to hear. A couple of other conversations I've had, there was a political candidate here. We've been talking a lot about systemic racism on the podcast over the last several months. And oftentimes the conversation talks about, you know, Confederate monuments or racism. And she turned it around on me. She said, yes, that's true. But there are also a lot of people who fought against racism and who fought for liberation and who are fighting to create a better life. And we can't forget those either in this conversation. And that's one of the realities that she wants to get to. And it really was a wonderful time because when guests especially surprise me or turn the tables on me, that's actually kind of fun because it gets me to think differently. And as I prepare, I record these conversations a few weeks before they actually run. You know, every time, you know, you learn about people. And I think when I ask them about what they like to do, whether it's making the mandalas or people who talk about taking a walk or reading a certain piece of literature, even watching Tiger King of all things, you know, they open themselves up, they let themselves be vulnerable, which I think is really important. I think that to me, that's been the biggest gift of this podcast is that people who ordinarily would be somebody out on, you know, in their job, have now given me permission to talk to them about what's keeping them healthy. And that's why this is so important to me too, because it's keeping me healthy. I'm very much a person who likes to be out among people and with people. And especially the first few months when we were literally pretty much shut in, that was really, really tough. And while I have a family here, you know, it's only, you know, I love my husband and there's only so much you can get enjoyment. You know, sometimes chihuahuas can grate on you a little bit. And so I get to learn how to be kind with the little ones. But that's been meaningful to me.
Yeah. I think, this idea of being vulnerable in communication with someone that you talked about, you know, interviewing a grief counselor, and sort of being jarred into a place of vulnerability and openness. It was refreshing, you know, that brings to mind for me the idea of honesty, projecting truth from within to your without, and and back and backwards. And it gets back a little bit to this idea of coordinated attack on the integrity of the media, the integrity of the community processes. You know, one thing that I have a fear of right now is the lack of faith in our voting process. And with that, you know, front and center right now in all of our lives on this national level, I was wondering your thoughts on the media's role in promoting or highlighting how the voting process can be an honest thing, an event that happens with integrity.
Yeah, it's a great question, especially now. And one of the things that has made me very optimistic is that many journalists are using this opportunity to be very aggressive and passionate fact checkers for whatever claims, whether it's the president or whether it's someone else who makes a particular claim. You know, is it true? And if not, why? If so, why? And it's been really challenging, especially in an environment where social media is so pervasive. You know, Facebook has recently made some major changes to how it addresses advertising, how it addresses organizations like QAnon or others. And I've been briefed actually by Facebook executives. So I've had firsthand knowledge of how they're doing it. And I understand why a lot of people are skeptical, because they have not enforced these rules in the past and they have let a lot of things slide. But rather than say, well, we don't like you, you know, I think it's an opportunity for us to partner with them to say, how do we make this better? And we have to, because if we truly believe in this democratic system, I would say it goes back to the very local level as well. I asked, you know, a few years ago, so I do a lot of work on electoral politics and reform and democracy. And in 2016, after the president was elected, he committed to, you know, sussing out voter fraud, created this commission, made all this fanfare. The commission was around for only a few months because the premise of it was false. The premise was that there's a rampant voter fraud. And in fact, even in surveys of elections officers like secretaries of state, no one could determine that it actually happened. You know, there was speculation, but there was no proof. And I went back, I've written a lot about that. And I went back also to say, we've got to ask our local officials, do you not believe in your own system? You know, and so asking those questions, I've interviewed the Secretary of State of Tennessee. I've interviewed people who are in elections commissions to ask them that precise question. Do you not believe in your system? And if not, why? All of them to this point have believed in their system. They believe it works. You know, where the differences are in terms like voter suppression. I use it perhaps a little bit more liberally than others because I truly believe that it exists. You know, laws that have been created to make it more difficult for people to go to the polls. There are workarounds, but I often remind people, you know, I'm in a position of privilege where I can take a day off to go vote if I wanted to. Other people can't. You know, and, you know, the question of ID, you know, it sounds easy, but it's not as easy as you want. When I got my license in Tennessee, it took 4 hours waiting. I had the luxury of time. I was on vacation. You know, most people don't, especially now if you're an essential worker. When do you do that? And then you also have to balance homeschool. You have to balance, you know, trying to pay the bills, all these other things. And, you know, I do think it's important to make sure that the person who's voting is, in fact, the actual voter. But there are ways to do it that are more effective. And what I found actually is that as we look at all 50 states and we have an honest election system. We really do. We've created these checks and balances. And even in a place I can speak more to Tennessee, of course, because I live here, but you have your local election commission, you have your secretary of state, and then you also have several monitors like the League of Women Voters, like the American Civil Liberties Union, like other organizations that ensure that things are being done as they should, that examine the data, that look for anomalies. And that's important too, because, you know, are mistakes possible? Absolutely. I will tell you, I lived in Florida during the whole Hanging Chads debacle, if you remember that.
For sure.
I was in Fort Myers, Florida. And that part of the state didn't have the problems that the Miami area did, and Palm Beach, pardon me. But it was still it was embarrassing for Florida, because it was one of those things like, why can't you manage your elections? And it was a great question, and it caused new technology to come in. I'll tell you some of the things that I am happy about in recent years. And I don't know how they do it in Colorado, but they finally have a kind of a paper ballot that's in addition to the machine. You vote on your your electronic machine, your computer, and then you put in a paper record and it records what you voted in and you put it in. And that way, if anybody has a question, there needs to be a recount for some reason, you can now compare those votes to what the computer says. Those things are, you know, one of the things that also makes me hopeful is that none of the computers, the voting machines are connected to the internet. So it's not like someone could come in and hack you because they're not connected to a network. And those are other things. We help explain this to people, you know, and so the difficulties right now that we have is there's so much confusion because of the messages from the president, because of the court cases that have gone on in this state and elsewhere. So, for example, in Texas, where my parents live, you know, the governor wanted to limit voting boxes where you returned your mail-in ballot or your absentee ballot to just one per county. I mean, Texas is an enormous state. I mean, that becomes a transportation issue then for some people. And the court basically said, no, you can't do that. So in some cases, the court is siding with what I think are the people who are really trying to expand access. That's really going to be our challenge over the next couple of years, number one. So we had this question in the vice presidential debate about whether the president would, and I don't mean to fill the air with the president. I certainly don't want to be disrespectful to you or to him. But I only say it because this is the news that we're in right now. But, you know, the vice president was asked, will you accept a peaceful transfer of power? I was very disappointed by the answer because the answer should have been yes. You know, if I lose, I will accept. If I win, you know, my opponent should accept. That's our system. And, you know, there have been cases of fraud over the years. You know, famously Lyndon Johnson, when he was running for Senate, had that box that apparently was withheld from votes. You know, we I'm from Chicago originally, so we have all sorts of jokes about how voting happens there. But ultimately, the main thing is to constantly be vigilant. We can never lose our focus, because when we do and we start to wonder, well, what happened to our democracy? Well, where were you to fight for it? Because these things don't happen on their own. I mean, it happens by how you vote. And also how you act in between those votes. You know, did you push policies that were favorable to your position? And if you haven't gone to a city council meeting or a school board meeting, then maybe you should. You know, that's an opportunity to help direct some of that really important policy.
David, I think we're going to wrap up. I joke that sometimes so far in this new podcast endeavor, I ask banana split questions where things are kind of stacked on top of one another. But one of the things I'm so impressed by who you are, your work. And we share some friends in common in Nashville, which is where I went to college at Belmont University, where the last presidential debate will happen here in a few days as we're recording this. But one final question today for me is, you've talked about how you really believe in the promise of the American Republic and our democratic values. So I'd like to close today by just asking, what is keeping hope alive for you in these days and keeping that belief in our American Republic and democratic values going?
I think the basic answer for me is the people that I encounter every day who are helping each other. Whether it's the tornadoes that hit Nashville and you had this array of volunteers go out and help people recover their life, whether you have people working together in a Black Lives Matter mural on a street in Nashville, or people coming to try to understand a very complicated issue, I find tremendous acts of charity and philanthropy every single day. You know, when we get too wrapped up into the news cycle or the punditry, it distracts us from that. And in fact, there's so many wonderful, good people, you know, who, and even when I have those moments, because I do have those moments where I just want to punch a wall. And I find, you know, faith for me is a very important part of my own, you know, I would say one of the things that has been most meaningful to me over the last year has been reading to a little boy at a school. A local public school, and unfortunately that had to stop because of the pandemic, but I look forward to it every Wednesday, and we would read together and draw together, and I have a little drawing that he made for me that says, I love my reading buddy. We drew together, it's on my refrigerator, and it's a reminder to me that those small kind acts, you know, are reciprocal. You know, I benefit from it as much as he did for me. He had an adult who paid attention to him, and I had a child who really opened my heart. And those are the things that make me very hopeful. And I'm hoping that I can do that again, you know, as soon as it's safe to do so. But yeah, but I'm very optimistic, and but also very, yeah, I'm realistic when it comes to the fact that we have to be vigilant and have to be strong and loving to each other and kind. And I think we're going to get out of this much better than we were before, because I don't want things to go back to what they were before, because not everything was great before the pandemic. The fact that I'm talking to my siblings multiple times a week when I might have talked to them once or twice a year, you know, those kinds of things where you realize that connection matters. And that's what we need to be. We need more of that. And I certainly have my own political views of where things should go, but I'll just end that we all benefit when we respect strong democratic institutions and when we value the truth and when we listen to each other.
David Plazas is the Opinion and Engagement Director for the USA Today Network, Tennessee. David, we are so grateful that you said yes to this conversation today. We admire your work from afar. You can check out David Plazas' work via thetennessean.com. He also is the host of Tennessee Voices video podcast. David, thank you.
Thank you, Andrew and David. This has been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Hyphenated Life is a production of Pine Street Church in Boulder, Colorado, hosted by Andrew Daugherty and David Lomdieu.
The podcast is produced by Phil Norman and executive producer Alexi Molden. Special thanks to our guest today and the Leo Hill Trust of Boulder, Colorado.